Welcome to today's edition of Time in the Vineyard with pastor teacher Jeff Torring. Today's broadcast is being brought to you from the pulpit of Liberty Valley Church, Northfield, Ohio.
Matthew 26, 21. And as they did eat, he said, Verily I say unto you, that one of you shall betray me. And they were exceeding sorrowful, and began every one of them to say unto him, Lord, is it I? He answered and said, And he that dippeth his hand with me in the dish, the same shall betray me. The Son of Man goeth as it is written of him. But woe unto that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It had been good for that man if he had not been born. Then Judas, which betrayed him, answered and said, Master, is it I? He said unto him, Thou hast said. And as they were eating, Jesus... What I would like to do then is if you would throw your ribbon in here and we'll come back to Matthew 26 just for setup in Hebrews chapter 11. Obviously written to the Hebrews with a Jewish flavor, written for a specific people that would be deemed as God's people, the children of Israel. It applies to us as Gentiles and as believers in Christ, but still there are certain elements to the book that are specifically to the Jew and for the Jew. And so as Paul comes down towards the end of the book written to the Hebrews, he's giving some encouragement. The whole book is actually trying to encourage the Jew for the transformation to Christianity, but still not leaving behind the traditions there. And so we find in chapter 11, we know this as the faith hero. It's the hero of faith. It's a kind of just a summary of the Old Testament of some of the great heroes of the faith that have come down. And he's using this to encourage them. Look at this guy and look at this guy. When he goes through some of the lists, if you jump in right around verse 32, it says, And what shall I say more? For the time would fail me to tell of all the heroes of the faith, Gideon and Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David also. And it's meant to bring memory so that the reader is reminiscing as you hear these names of all the stories of these men who acted upon because they believed, their lives reflected that they believed and they were downright heroes. Samuel and the prophets, it says, who through faith subdued kingdoms. There's just a marvelous thing. It says, through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions. And he goes through these things. And then, of course, the Bible never paints a picture that is overly pretty. The Bible always paints a picture that is true. And so, even though he goes through this list of heroes, he reminds them, too, that through all these years, we have taken casualties. The Church of God is under attack always. There's cannons that are fired at the hull, and it's not fake. So even though there has been great heroes, we do take casualties. There is what the Bible calls others. There, verse 36, and others. Others had trials of cruel mockings, of scourgings. We're familiar with the scourging that Jesus took, beaten so badly that his back was so tore up that his kidneys were exposed. There's nothing necessarily heroic about it. Although I could say that there's not a single person who was a believer who went through these things. None of them were disappointed when it came time to breathe their last breath, which is the hope. There are casualties that are taken. God doesn't always come to rescue people. Tied them to the block, the torture block, stretched them out. Some of them had their organs removed without any anesthesia, waiting for them to deny Christ as Savior. This is what the Bible calls in Hebrews chapter 11, the others. The others had trial of cruel mockings, scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. I make a habit of, in my spare time, I like to follow foreign policy and military strategies because I try to think of these things and I'm inspired by them to try to run the church that way. We are in warfare, and so there is some benefit to it. And so lately I've been reading one of my books, The Difficult Decisions of Vietnam, toward the end when they were deciding, do we pull out or do we not pull out? This isn't a victory here. And so the difficulties that they encountered of the pullout of Vietnam and the life that was lost. And then last week, I also was into and following the fight for Fallujah. And so that was an interesting thing because they not only told some of the stories of the veterans that were going in to clear the buildings of Fallujah, but they also followed the response from their families, which was definitely interesting. And so I came across one particular Marine who was an only child, and he was of the inner city, single mom, had a son late in life, and it was her darling, you know. The father wasn't in the picture. There wasn't very many at all people in the picture. And so she has this darling son, one, and they're in the inner city, just those two living life. And then at about 17, he decides, well, I think I want to join the Marines. And he was very inspired by the D-Day things that took place in World War II, the heroes that had gone to pass. And so this gentleman signs up to fight in Afghanistan and ends up in Iraq. And then on the third day of taking Fallujah, he took a bullet that came in right beneath the helmet, right near the ear, and took him out. The interesting part is then they record what took place. Then the Marines come to the door of the mom to tell her the news that your only son is gone. And she's just absolutely devastated, of course. There's others. There are others, but what he's saying in this chapter is we have put thousands on the run. I mean, we have really taken the trenches. We have taken the hills. The Bible says that one man shall put thousands to the run and 10 men shall put 10,000 to the run. And the truth of the matter is, as though our ship takes on water at times, we are victorious and triumphant. The ship of Jesus Christ, the church of God, is as frightening to the devil as all things. And so we have put them on the run. We have made them retreat. And so he says then in verse 34, he says, we've quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword. Out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. We've put thousands on the run. We have rescued literally hundreds of millions from every tribe, tongue, and nation all around the world. People have been rescued and saved out of the grips of the devil. So he's painting a full picture for them. He says, but what you need to know, though, is that it is a long haul. Chapter 12, he says, wherefore, seeing we are also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, after all the witnesses that we are around, and all the stories of the Old Testament, the people that have gone before us, he's reminding them that we are a part of this. This is our heritage. We are not separated. The heritage just continues on. And even till this day, there are wonderful heroes of the faith. And there are also wonderful casualties. But what he wants to know, look what he says. He says, because of this, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, the small things, and let us run with patience, endurance, the race that is set before us. He's saying there, this is a long haul race. Some of the casualties we take isn't because of bullets or guns. It's simply because it is such a long haul race. This isn't a 3K or a 5K. This is like a 2,500K. It's such a long run. Some people, they just quit. They weren't wounded. You just get tired of it. I'm tired of running. He's telling them, you need to keep your eyes fixed then on the prize. Because it is such a long haul. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. You got to keep your eyes fixed there because there are so many distractions on the 600th mile of the race that you can easily fall off. So then years later, now, they came back to that mother of the son. Try to follow up. She says, I am incredibly lonely. He was everything that I had. I'm here in the city. I have no other family. It was just him and I for 17 years. And now I have no one. She says, I am just incredibly lonely. But she said, but it was worth it. Because my son died for freedom. He died for the red, the white, and the blue. I'm thinking of buying two flags for the front, and I want nice ones. You know, you can buy cheap flags that are made in China, and we're not going to go there, but I want to buy two nice flags for the front, and I like the way the new flags look when they're nice ones, full-blown American flags. The red is, and the blue is so vivid. It actually has a sheen to it when they're new and they're folded just right and the light hits them just right. And it seems as though the stars, even though they're white, they're so white and brilliant. They almost have a silver kind of brilliance to them, even though within the threading of the white stars as you see this. And I'm looking at that and I thoroughly am in honor to be an American. But we have to remember that sometimes old glory does fade. It'll just fade over time. And so what he says is you have to worry about being discouraged. We take on more casualties for simple discouragement because the time goes long and the run is long. And along the run, you may not think that you're having as many victories as you would like. And so the problem is then the stars begin to fade, the red begins to fade, the blue turns a little pale. You become just downright discouraged. And look at it in verse 12. He says, wherefore, lift up the hands which hang down, the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet. The idea of walking through stones in the mountains, in the Mediterranean, in the Middle East, where you're just walking through these crooked paths of stones, it seems to take forever. It's just this scourge of walking. Make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame, when your legs are hurting, I mean you're wounded by discouragement, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way. You'll end up actually losing your leg or limb. He says, but let it rather be healed. Follow peace with all men, holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Now look what he says in 15. Looking diligently. Diligently looking. Lest any man fail of the grace of God. Now here's the phrase. Lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you. The Bible has this thread throughout. It's called the root of bitterness. If you eat this plant, you get nauseous. In some ways, there are some things that are translated Chernobyl, relating to the nausea of nuclear poison. He says that in this long walk, beware, look diligently, because this is such a long haul. When we're entering our 14th year of ministry here. I didn't think I was going to live that long. He says, look diligently, lest this root of bitterness springing up trouble you. You can see it on people's faces. You're discouraged. That's why we have communion. Jesus said, do this in remembrance. You have to remember. You have to keep your eyes fixed on the prize. There's a prize coming. Keep your eyes fixed. Because you may be okay today, but you might not be in a year. So prevent some a little. That's what he's talking about if you look back into Matthew chapter 26 when he is just about to institute the first communion service. Look back in Matthew 26. What I'm going to do then is to bring in the Lord's Supper and the teaching in its context. Because most people don't understand what the context is. They don't know why did Jesus do this or the how. What's the purpose of it? I mean, the denominations are split over what we have before us. And it's in most part, it's because of a biblical illiteracy. And actually within Protestant churches or Baptist churches or any church, it doesn't matter. There is such a dearth of the Word of God. There's a famine in the land. Not of bread or of corn or of wine, but of the Word of God. And so people don't even know what they're doing when they approach the Lord's table. I just want to run through a few things that led up to the Lord's Supper. When we come into chapter 26 of Matthew, we have to realize that by now the multitudes that were following Jesus as he taught are gone. There was 5,000, 10,000, sometimes 25, 30,000 people listening as Jesus would belt out sermons with his full volume through the grassy hillsides of Judea. And so now we come to 26. The multitudes are gone. Jesus has given a few pretty scathing sermons that have run the people out. I mean, on purpose, he ran them out. In fact, one particular service, the disciples came to Jesus and he said, "Master, don't you know that you offended the Pharisees on that one?" That was an offensive sermon. And then, of course, the tipping point, he raises Lazarus from the dead. Now what are we going to do? We have a guy who was dead for 4 days, risen from the dead. Now we raised him, and now he's joining our meetings. No one can deny this. And so Jesus, it says, could no longer walk throughout Judea. It's absolutely dangerous. We also have to realize by now it's been 3 years. The apostles have been with him for 3 long years. I mean, long ones. They worked and worked and worked. And they were a little confused. Because they were looking for this conqueror, the coming deliverer, who would rule the rod of iron from Psalm 2. This great deliverer like Moses. And then that's not really what it looks like. I mean, Jesus is teaching meekness and humility and forgiveness. And John the Baptist himself, the forerunner of the king, says, "Hey, should we look for somebody else? Are you the one?" And now there's talk about killing him. Look at it. He says, "And it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said unto his disciples, 'You know that after 2 days is the feast of the Passover, and the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified.'" They are in crisis mode. Verse 3 of chapter 26, "Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people unto the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas. And they consulted in this little meeting that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him." So it's confirmed. There's a hit out on his head. And everyone knows it. Because you got this guy walking around who was once dead and is now alive. We have to kill him. Otherwise, the world will go after him. Now notice what happens next. Verse 6. "Now when Jesus was in Bethany, in the house of Simon the leper, there came unto him a woman having an alabaster box of very precious ointment, very, very expensive perfume, and poured it on his head as they sat at meat." Now John records for us after he does this that Judas Iscariot was furious about this situation. He said, "Hey, that alabaster box, that costly ointment that was normally saved probably for her wedding night, that could have been given to the poor. I mean, we could have sold that." And so they had this little business meeting where Judas Iscariot is just hot about this. "That was a waste of money. We could have sold that. We could have given that to the poor." And John also records for us in his gospel that Judas didn't really care about the poor. Judas held the bag. He was the treasurer. He was a crook. And so unlikely, that would be normal for him to be upset about it. Because he's scamming off the top. But in this passage here, we're not talking about Judas. Look what Matthew writes. He says, "But when his disciples saw it, they had indignation, saying, 'To what purpose was this waste?'" That means all the disciples were hot. What we're seeing here are stress cracks. You ever have those? You're just discouraged enough where you start to break. You got to remember, this has been 3 long years of walking with the Messiah, walking with Jesus, this rabbi. Normally, when you walk with a rabbi, you have privileges. But you get none when you're walking with Jesus. I mean, you can be healed, but as far as financially speaking, not every day was a big healing. A lot of it was just teaching. Teaching, preaching, teaching, preaching. So it was 3 years that was packed full. It was exciting, but it was very rigorous. We're even taught in a couple places that the disciples, they were too busy to eat. They were going to and fro, so much so, working so hard all day, all night, and into the morning, straight through. It says that they worked so much that they didn't even have time to eat. And then we also know that throughout this, they were also too poor to eat. Now, we read these stories when Jesus fed the 5,000 or the 10,000 or the 20,000 with a few little fish and a few loaves of bread, and we teach the Sunday school kids that. But if you look at that closely, what does it say? They came to him and they said, "Master, the crowd has been with us for 3 days and they haven't eaten. What shall we do?" Now, put yourself on the first day. We have been working in the Mediterranean sun, preaching and teaching and harding these thousands around, helping them all day long. And by the end of the day, we're hungry. But day number one goes by. There's no breakfast, there's no lunch, and there is no dinner. And then they work throughout the evening, working, 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 trying to take care of this crowd. Day two, no breakfast, no lunch. And then again, dinner time, no dinner. Why? They don't have any money. They don't have any food. I'm finally the third day. Breakfast, nothing. Lunch, nothing. It's the end now. We haven't eaten anything in 3 days. And then they come to him and they said, "Master, you've got to send these people away. We haven't eaten anything in 3 days. And what did they say? "Well, we do have this kid here with a lunch with a couple fish and some bread. But you know what they're thinking? That's ours. We haven't eaten anything in days. We've been working for you, serving you, and we haven't eaten a lick." That'll make you stress. Not only do we work and work and work, but we're so poor. I mean, remember, these guys sold everything that they had and followed him. They quit working their fishing jobs. They had no income other than donations. And they are just downright cracking. Until finally one falls to a temptation. Look at it in 14. "Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went unto the chief priests." This was not an easy decision. I mean, they all were cracking. And there was huge temptation by the Pharisees and by the devil himself. "Turn on him. You don't need this. You don't need to do this. Turn on him." "One of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went out unto the chief priests and said unto them, 'What will ye give me? And I will deliver him unto you.' And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver," which is relatively a lot of money for a guy who's dirt poor. Now, there's more to it than that, because they are looking for someone to do this. I mean, they're advently looking. They just didn't come across Judas Iscariot and say, "He'll give us this thing." And then he goes to the garden, and you know, the scene in the garden where Judas comes and kisses Jesus on the cheek, you know, so that they would know who he is. They knew who he was. That's not why Judas kissed Jesus on the cheek. The Roman Empire had law. It was Pax Romana. It was somewhat, it was corrupt, but it was a system of law. And so what they were doing here, when in the beginning, when it says that the assembly came together and consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him, what they were looking for was false witnesses. We need to have witnesses, and we need a signature of a witness saying that Jesus was guilty of blasphemy and guilty of breaking the law, so that we can then enter our paperwork into the Roman government so that we can take him and kill him. And so this temptation came out. They were looking earnestly. "Anybody, anybody, anybody, can you give us what we need? We will pay you." And so Judas, under the pressure of all these things of 3 years, crushed beneath the load, and says, "For 30 pieces, I haven't eaten in days." And it don't look like it's going well, because he just said he's about to be killed. And you know what happens if they kill him? We're goners too. We're with him. They know it. So verse 16, "And from that time he sought opportunity to betray him. Now the first day of the feast of the unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus, saying unto him, 'Where wilt thou that we prepare to eat the Passover?'" Where are we going to eat the Passover? Now the law says that you had to eat the Passover within the city. Couldn't eat Passover wherever you want to go. Let me tell you, you can't go to church wherever you want to go. You can't just go to the woods and have church. Those people are heretics. You can't go do that. There's a prescribed method of where worship is supposed to be in a corporate manner. Same thing with the Passover. The law was as you had to be within the city. But we don't want to go in the city. Are you crazy? There's a hit on your head. It's a little phrase that I just love. You know, Doubting Thomas, you know, the guy says, I won't believe unless I stick my hand in his side and put my finger in his hole in the hand. I'm not going to believe, I won't believe, I won't believe. Before he says that, though, something very interesting he says. They're going to Judea. They're asking you to come to the Passover. And Thomas gives this little sentence. He goes, well, you might as well go die with him. An unbeliever. He knew. You go there, and we ain't coming out alive. But let's go. Because they're going to get us anyway. How many of the apostles actually lived? One. And it's just because he wouldn't burn in oil when they put him in the Isle of Patmos and they burned him alive, he didn't die. That's stress. That's called discouragement. Verse 18, Jesus says, go into the city, such a man. Jesus has it already planned out. That's called what I taught Minutemen due diligence. He already had things planned. He said, go into the city to such a man and say unto him, the Master saith, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at thy house with my disciples. And the disciples did as Jesus had appointed them, and they made ready the Passover. Now, in between verse 19 and 20, a few things need to be said. Because there's things happening in between there. They're in the upper room, but they're arguing in the upper room. Remember the story when the disciples are arguing, who's the greatest in the kingdom? I think it's me. Peter, James, and John, they send their mom, remember earlier? My boys want to sit on your right hand in the kingdom. Make sure that my boys sit on the right hand and on the left hand when your kingdom comes. And so in the upper room here, what they're figuring is we got to jockey for our right place in the kingdom because we want to have a preeminence in this kingdom that is coming. And so what do you find here in between verse 19 and 20 up in this room as they're getting ready for the Passover is there's a bunch of arguing going on about who's the greatest in the kingdom. I think it should be me. I don't think it's going to be you. It definitely should be me. Peter says, I certainly am a ringleader. It should certainly be me. And then, of course, Jesus then steps up during all this squabbling, silently, secretly. He just gets up from the table and then he takes off his tunic that was expensive. He takes off that and then he puts on a towel and he wraps it around him and then he begins to wash their feet. And Peter's like, you ain't washing my feet. That's what servants do. But he doesn't say, give me that towel, I'll wash them for you. You want to know why? He says, I don't want to lose my position in the kingdom. Servants wash feet. And if I lose my seat at the table, some guy's going to take it. And then, so I ain't getting up. Because it's all about me. Things are starting to fall apart. So verse 21, and it says, and as they did eat, he said, verily I say unto you that one of you shall betray me. Oh, good. That's what we need. It's totally falling apart, and now we got a rat inside the group. Oh, man. It's really falling apart. Verse 22, and they were exceeding sorrowful, and began every one of them to say unto him, Lord, is it I? I mean, they know it isn't them. It isn't, I mean, you're not planning on betraying him, are you? I mean, you know you're not. But they are so mentally distraught and cracking by this time is they don't even trust themselves. And so they begin to ask, Lord, is it me? I don't even know up from down. Is it me? 23, and he answered and said, he that dippeth his hand with me in the dish, the same shall betray me. But it's whispering going on because it's a very quiet time. Well, at certain portions of it. Because then we know that John records as they're laying there, they're like, is it me? Is it me? Is it me? Is it me? And then John goes like this to Peter. Hey, hey, hey. Ask him who it is. John is the one who's really close to Jesus. He goes, Lord, who is it? And he says, it's the one that's going to stick his hand in the dish and dip it with me. It's Judas. 24, the Son of Man goeth as it is written of him, but woe unto that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It had been good for that man if he had never been born.
Then Judas, look at this, which betrayed him, answered and said, Master, is it I? You know he knows who it is. He was checking to see, do you know who it is, Jesus? Is it up? Jesus says, you've said it. It is you. Go do it quickly. Then as they were eating Jesus, just as they were eating, the captain of the ship is as cool and as calm at the helm as can be. When all the people are falling apart, Jesus just says, and as they were eating Jesus, amidst all the squabbling, the sorrow, and the pressures, he took bread, stops in the middle of it, doesn't say a word. He took his bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it unto the disciples. And you know it was incredibly silent when he stood up to do this, because they knew he had a special way of blessing the bread. That's how they recognized him after he was risen from the dead. He took it and he blessed it and he broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat, this is my body. And he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, drink ye all of it, for this is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. We have to stop here again, because right now what they're thinking in verse 28 is, this is it. This is the end. He's about to be killed, crucified. It was a good run. This is it. They're going to crucify an innocent man, the Lord of glory. But I want you to know, because he says something very interesting here concerning this. He says in 30, and when they had sung a hymn, they went out into the Mount of Olives, when the whole thing is over. Now here, this is what you got to know. The Passover had regulations that were given from Moses, and they had just regular rules that were given from Moses for the Passover. Now the Passover was a very interesting thing to take place in, because the Passover had bitter herbs mixed in with the meat, and yet there was wine mixed in. So it was a very odd thing, and it was supposed to be that way. The eating of it was bitter herbs, so when you ate something, it was bitter in your mouth. It was supposed to remind us of sin, and of death, and of hell, and all the things that go along with that. It is a bitter bite when you take it. I mean, it's pungent, but yet it's very bitter. And then what happens is you have the sadness and the sorrow that comes from the bitterness of eating it, yet you wash it down with wine. Now, we all know what wine is made for. It's a drink that's supposed to bring a good time. It's supposed to be a celebratory drink. This is something that you do at weddings. He made sure we don't run out of wine at weddings. This is for celebrational things. And so when you go through the Passover, there were four different cups of wine that were drank. Red wine, full. What you would do is you drink one in the very beginning, and then after you drank that cup, they had a psalm or a portion of a psalm, and then they would read that psalm, and a lot of times they would sing it to melody. And necessarily at first it wasn't sung very well, you know, it was kind of like, well, we're at the beginning of this, you know, and this psalm, whatever it was, and they would kind of say it, but with a little bit of melody, you know, because it is a psalm. But throughout the Passover, then you went to the second cup. Now you fully drank the first cup of wine, but now we're on the second cup of wine. And so now, as soon as you're finished with this second cup, then there's another psalm that was said. And usually it was just a line or two. It wasn't the whole psalm, but it was just that you say it, but it became a little bit more melody, because now we're on our second cup of wine. And then the third cup of wine, they would give you the third cup. And then, okay, now I like this psalm. And so there's a little more joy in the way that it's sung. And it's designed to be this way. It's supposed to increase as the Passover feast goes, because it starts out and it's recognizing our sin and the humility of it. But then as the celebration goes, now we're on our third cup of wine, full third cup. Now, you're one cup and two cups and third. Hey, now, wait a second. You know, so now the song, the third psalm is kind of sung. I mean, people are kind of joining in a little bit. We've sang our third one. But now, yeah, the regulation was actually four cups of wine. That's why when it ended, it says, and when they had sung a hymn, by then, they're feeling pretty good. Now, no one's drunk to the point of sin, but they've had four full cups of wine. And so when they leave here, it is a celebration. They are happy. Their family is all together. The tribe, people, aunts, uncles, people they haven't seen, are all gathered together. And they got the hymns on their mind. They had a couple cups of wine. Now look what Jesus says. Now this is crucial to our understanding of what's before us in the Lord's table. Because, look at it, what he says.
After he says, verse 28, "This is my blood in the New Testament, which is shed for many," talking of the cup of wine, "for the remission of sins. But I say unto you, I will not drink henceforth of the fruit of the vine." There was a cup left. There was still another expected cup to drink. And he changed it. Now he instituted it as Lord's Supper. But there was one more. And he says, "I'm not drinking it." He says, actually, "I say unto you, I will not drink henceforth of this fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." What they were all thinking was, is this is the end. This is absolutely horrible. We are all going to die. This is a terrible, terrible ending. And what Jesus is saying to them is, that is absolutely not what it is, because there's a cup left. And this cup that I have with you, you think it's the end, but it's actually just the beginning. I'm promising you that fourth and final cup will be drunk, but it will be drunk when the kingdom comes. In power and in glory, with all the expectations, the fulfillment of all the prophets and all the coming king, Daniel, the stone that was cut out without hands, that comes down and sets up the kingdom. Jesus says, at that time, I will drink the fourth cup. He wants the celebration to be. Somebody came in a couple weeks ago under the church and they said, "Why don't you have a cross anywhere? I don't understand. You don't have Jesus hanging on the cross. I don't see any crosses. I don't see anything around." I said, "Because our Lord is no longer on the cross. He has risen from the dead just like He said that He would. And so we don't do that. We just celebrate the empty tomb, because this is what Jesus is saying to do." And so that tells you why He is saying, do this in remembrance of Me till I come. That is the purpose. The glory is coming. The fourth cup is coming. Then you would see they sung a hymn, joyful, singing the song.
You've been listening to Time in the Vineyard with Pastor Teacher Jeff Toring. Today's broadcast was brought to you from the pulpit of Liberty Valley Church, Northfield, Ohio. For more information, you can call the church at 330-554-7606 or check us out on the web at libertyvalleychurch.org. That's libertyvalleychurch.org.